Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
I'm delighted to be here, and I'm so grateful to be following Dr. Kuhn's wonderful address. He has addressed, very importantly, a major set of aspects of the issue of the relationship between Christian thought and academic work, intellectual labor. And I'm glad that he has talked because, I mean, if there's anything to be said about it, he got it said. And so I can go on to deal with another aspect. And that is, I can call it briefly the sociological side of the aspect. Because the truth of the matter is we have those two areas to deal with. And the person who is absolutely convinced of the things that Dr. Kuhn's has said can still be embarrassed at being thought unscientific. Whereas if they really absorbed what he had to say and were really concerned about truth and research and all that sort of thing, they would say, well, you know, that's no different from being thought un-Republican or something of that sort. And so you see, what we're dealing with here is the power of worldview. And I want to try to make as clear as possible what this is and talk about how it works in our context. So you'll be following along up here, and I think all of you have a sheet to make some notes on, just in case you need to write something down. I will enlarge a little bit on this. But let's just begin with the idea of worldview. Basic idea of worldview, as you see here, is your worldview consists of your assumptions about the realities and values that govern you and the world in which you live. Now let me illustrate it. How many of you here tonight worried that coming to this meeting you would be eaten by a dinosaur? May I see your hands? Oh, we got one over here. I think he's faking. See, that reflects your worldview. That dinosaurs aren't there. Or to mention another reference to Steve Weinberg, I've heard him say, for example, that when he goes to do his research, he doesn't worry about fairies. He says, well, you know, it's logically possible, but he doesn't worry about it. Well, that's his worldview. See, his worldview is basically your assumptions. Now, you see, there not being any dinosaurs on the UCLA campus is a part of your worldview, even though you didn't think about it. And that's an important thing to understand about worldviews, is that you don't have to think about them in order for them to determine your behavior. Now, we need to just sort of let that soak in because you can't live without a worldview. And that's why I say on the screen here, a worldview is a biological reality. That is to say, it's built right into your life. It's built into your body. Your body responds in terms of your worldview, whether you think about it or not. Right? And so your worldview is most clearly seen in the things you don't think about and talk about. And partly because, you know, if you have to think about and talk about all the stuff that determines your actions, you're dead. You can't get across the street. That's where we're made to be biological units and live in a world with a kind of unified 360-degree orientation, which very often is far removed from our conscious thinking. And that's the picture of the person who doesn't want to, I mean, if someone, we have philosophers, for example, who if they thought that someone they respected thought they were unscientific, they wouldn't sleep at night. They'd sit up and worry about it. Even though, as Dr. Coons has shown, there really is no unified, consistent picture of what it means to be scientific in general. A physicist, yes. A chemist, yes. A physiologist, stretch it a little bit, an economist, that's, you know, sociologist. You won't get all the way over to English literature with that one. But still, I mean, there is a solid meaning to science as long as you're talking about a particular science. And scientists, when they're about their work as a physicist or whatever, they don't generally worry about worldviews, but they still have one. And then we carry one as academic people. We kind of carry a rather ragtag, unexamined set of assumptions about the world, and often we palm them off on science. Since it's just after Easter, I remember a few years ago, a very, very bright young man, a philosophy major and an outstanding Christian, was walking along with one of our professors from the religion department, and this young man brought up the issue of the resurrection of Christ. And the professor said, well, of course that couldn't have happened because that would be contrary to the laws of physics. Now, this young man, he wasn't in a position to say, well, now, professor, which law was that? Would you just help me work through that with me? See? But that's a part of that professor's worldview. And it's totally groundless. I mean, some interesting connection could be made. I don't mean to deny that. But to just say, well, it's contrary to the laws of physics. Well, which one? Right? And now, regularly in teaching courses in philosophy, I will have to challenge my students just to help them out with this, to say, now go to your chemistry professor and ask him for a reference to a refereed journal that shows that people do not survive the death of their brain. Now, of course, they don't do it because they'd be scared to death to do it. You see, there isn't any technical journal in chemistry that proves or even attempts to prove that people do not survive the death of their brain. You can't get an engagement with the issue because you have a worldview. Now, you know, our work is about knowledge. And that's the second screen you have there. We want to talk a little bit about knowledge and truth. And the university is supposed to be about knowledge. That's what you're here doing your work. I don't know whether you're undergraduate or graduate or whatever, but you're trying to gain knowledge. And one might say that that is what the university is about, is the gaining of knowledge. And one might also think that knowledge involves truth, that you cannot know what isn't true. But you see that one of the ironies about our Veritas Forum is Veritas is, it's kind of nice to put it in Latin. You know, I don't know how it would work if we had a truth forum. And the fact is that truth is in trouble. Now, not just religious or moral truth, but truth. And it's a little embarrassing. And, you know, we need to think deeply about that. I quote here a sentence from the WASC, that stands for Western Association of Schools and Colleges. They're the people that come around and decide whether or not your degree is any good. And I occasionally serve on these site committees. Some of you probably do the same, faculty here. And here's what they say. An institution of higher education is, by definition, dedicated to the search for truth and its dissemination. Now, Harvard actually had a little problem with this through the years in deciding what to do with truth, and they've changed their shield a number of times. primarily they were troubled about the issue of the unity of truth. And that is, does truth include the religious, the moral, and the other dimensions of truth? And gradually, through the years, there has been a kind of de facto drift in university affairs that relegates truth to just the natural world, shall we say. And so then our ability to represent God, personal character of the human being, spiritual side, all of that is eliminated from knowledge. But truth itself does not do that. I mean, I've given here a statement of what a truth is. A thought or statement is true if it is if what it is about is as that thought or statement represents it. So have you got a quarter in your pocket? You say, well, yes, I've got a quarter in my pocket. Well, that statement will be true if indeed your pocket has a quarter in it. Right? How can you get more elemental than that? But that's the general nature of truth. And truth is involved in knowledge because knowledge is our capacity to represent things as they are on an appropriate basis of thought and experience. And that can include authority. Nearly everything we know is known on the basis of authority. Do you know that the playoffs have now begun in the NBA? Well, some of you, I think, didn't know that. Well, take my word for it. It has. And so that's the general character of knowledge and truth. And we do need to reflect on that. And we need to understand that truth does not accommodate belief. Belief has to accommodate truth. No one has ever made a proposition true simply by believing it. Now, maybe their belief in it caused them to act and to bring something about that made the proposition true. But merely believing doesn't make propositions true. A group of people believing it doesn't help get up a movement, get a grant. It won't make it true. Right? A million Frenchmen have been wrong. Right? A million Americans have been wrong. So the bitterness of truth is its total indifference to human will and desire, together with the fact that human desire and will is set on reshaping the truth. This is the fundamental conflict in human life, is the conflict between desire or will and truth. And that conflict affects everything we do, including what we do on the university campus. So when it comes to these worldview questions, you see, the same issue of truth is there. And the question of how do we know the truth still applies to those, not just about whether in your pocket, but, for example, whether you're going to continue conscious existence when your brain is no longer functioning. Right? That's a good question of fact. And now, how we settle that, that's a difficult thing to argue about. But if it is true, then it's true regardless of what you or I may think about it. I often shock my students. We're discussing Descartes or someone. I ask them, what if it turns out you can't stop existing? Well, I mean, there you have Hamlet's problem, don't you? He wasn't sure he could make an end of himself with a bare bodkin to sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub, right? So now here's a question of fact or truth. And it has incredible bearings on how we approach our life. Am I fundamentally a material object that exists, gets organized by DNA and exists for a little while and then I stop existing? Or am I an unceasing spiritual being with an eternal destiny in God's universe? Wow, what a difference. See? Now, the main worldview questions, we can go on to slide 5. Basically, you can boil them down to three. You can add a couple more here and there. But the main ones are the nature of reality. What is reality? And then, of course, associated with this, what counts as knowledge of reality? Because knowledge enables us to negotiate reality and to hopefully live in some comfortable relationship to it. I often define reality as what you run into when you're wrong. And often that is an unpleasant experience. And so, you know, if you're counting on there being gas in your tank and it's not there, well, you will run into a reality that will strand you on the freeway, and who knows what will happen to you then. So, I mean, the nature of reality is a crucial question. Is a human being, go back to the case I'm using to illustrate, are they just a physical organism? Is all there is to thought and will and artistic genius and aspiration and knowledge of a whole field of French literature or something, is that just chemistry? So now, that's one of the major questions. Another major question is, who's well off? And you would immediately reply, of course, students at UCLA, because they have a bright future, right? And that's at USC, we promise everyone they're going to be successful. But this is a profound question. Who is well off? And can you still be well off if you have cancer? Or if you don't get your PhD? Or you don't have enough money to go on and get your BA degree? Can you still be well off? Who is well off? And that is a profound worldview question that reflects itself in nearly everything that we do. Who is a really good person? That's another big one. Actually, people are more concerned about that one than they are about who's well off. You can get a fight out of someone by questioning whether they're a really good person much quicker than you can by questioning whether they're well off. You know, you say, "Well, you must not be well off. You don't drive a Lexus." They'll look at you and shrug. But I can give you some other language that they will fight you right quickly, you see. So that's one of the deep questions. Am I a good person? It's one of the deepest worldview questions that human beings deal with. They're constantly concerned about it. And if you have any doubts about it, your blood pressure will immediately go up. Right. I mean, try it. I am a stinker. Blood pressure goes up, right? Or even Joe thinks I'm a stinker, right? Blood pressure goes up. And these are really pervasive questions that trouble us all the time. Well, let me hasten on. I mean, the truth of the matter is, I mean, we could list others, like how do you get to be a good person? That's a good one. Questions about what counts as knowledge is very big on the campus. See, those are worldview questions. They organize our lives as a whole. Now, what I want to say is that all teaching institutions, great teachers, even little teachers, give answers to these questions. And I mention here Jesus, because he's one of the most obvious people to mention. There never has been anyone who has been more influential in his teaching about these things than Jesus. But, of course, he's not the only one. Plato, the Buddha, Freud, and UCLA. UCLA answers these questions. They convey an impression of the truth of a certain worldview. In the university setting, the dominating worldview is expressed through what is accepted as research and what counts as possible knowledge. So I ask you about the dinosaur and whether or not any of you thought about being eaten by one on the way here tonight. No. Well, let me give you another one. Is there a single course of studies on this campus? And I don't, you know, I'm just picking on you because that's where we are. USC, Berkeley, or wherever it is, all the same. Is there a single course of studies on this campus that you're engaged in that regards knowledge of God as a part of the subject matter? A single one. Where you might be a part of your expertise in that field, or your grade might be determined by something you had to say about God. You see, that's the sociological reality. What Dr. Kuhn said is so cogent and so forceful. And when you know, you understand what he said, you just wonder, how can people not understand this? But the truth of the matter is, people who are caught up in the sociological wave will hear it all and dismiss it. Because to them, it's just like the dinosaur. And what I want to do this evening especially is to just take the time to insist that you are in a system which teaches a worldview without responsibly defending it. How is a worldview taught? Well, mainly it's taught by body language, facial expressions, tones of voice and inflections, looks, offhand remarks about people and events, by what is permissible, by example, how we treat people in class, out of class, colleagues, by who gets rewarded or punished in various ways in the academic or other context. Almost never is worldview taught by explicit statement. It is modeled. Explicit statement is usually happens only to reinforce what is taught indirectly in the ways just indicated above. So what we have to do with is a kind of orthodoxy, a secular orthodoxy, that is a sociological reality, not a rationally supported outlook. And what I'm doing tonight is more or less just calling attention to this and saying, look, this is something we have to deal with. UCLA answers the great questions in a pretty straightforward way, but they don't stand on the street corner and argue for it. For example, reality is the natural, sense-perceptible world. Just happens not to have dinosaurs in it. But that is assumed. Now, how is that taught? Well, that's the only thing they pay any attention to. That's how that's taught. The spiritual is not real and is not knowable. Now, that's been developing for a long period of time in our academic culture, and it is something that we have to just recognize that it's become increasingly popular to talk about the spiritual and spirituality, but any serious moral issue, for example, that arises will be treated not as something that is a subject for knowledge. And that's because it falls in the non-physical realm. You cannot make any sense out of morality if you stick to your physics. Same thing's true of logic. I mean, logical implication is not something in the physical world. That doesn't mean it's not real. One of the funny things in philosophy is you watch people, students who go into to study logic, and they want to know what it's all about, what it's really about, what is that, what are those funny symbols on the board? And they very quickly learn and are socialized that you do not ask that question. Because if you ask that question, that means you're too stupid to understand the answer. And we're not going to deal with it. And so, well, it's just a symbol. There are rules. Learn the rules. The student wants to know something about logic, and logic, like morality, is not a part of the physical world. Now, that doesn't mean it's not real. It doesn't mean we don't know it. But it means that under the prevailing outlook, we can't come to grips with it. Or you taught that you are your body, your brain. Taught that well-being is physical, social well-being, success, money, health. See, that's the system that is taught. And these answers are the assumptions of what we do and do not do. We wouldn't try to defend them except in some special philosophical context, possibly. But they are the assumptions that we live by. And we set up our curricula in those ways. And we judge the qualifications of people to teach or not to teach, to publish or not to publish, to get grants or not get grants. See, that's where the worldview takes hold. Now, I just want to say here that Jesus has an answer to these questions. And, you know, we ought to think once in a while that maybe Jesus was halfway smart. You know, after all, he's, without any question, the single most influential person in history. And actually, he got that way by being able to do a lot of stuff. You know, he did. Or if he didn't get it by doing a lot of stuff, then you have to explain how he got that way. And here are the answers that Jesus gives to these kinds of questions. Reality is God and his activities, including the natural world, physical, social, and so on. All of that is a part of reality. Secondly, the person is well off who has a life deriving from God and his kingdom. Now, that's his answer. And, you know, you put it right down there by the person who says, go to Sears and get the good life at a good price. Right? Or go to UCLA and become a financial success and a famous person who gets awards and grants. Good person is the person pervaded with God's kind of love, agape love. That's Jesus' teaching about who a good person is. And you can put it up against anybody else's answer and examine it and see how it goes. And then finally, you become a good person by becoming an apprentice of Jesus Christ. Okay? Now, that's a worldview. See? And that competes with the worldview that is taught at UCLA and USC and you name it, Harvard. Right? Now, what I'm really concerned to do this evening is just stress this fact. You have a worldview that basically it's a fairly unified worldview that is taught by inflection, action, model, and so on. If you get crosswise of that, you will soon find out that you're not acceptable. It's very powerful. It is a sociological reality. There's another worldview, which is the one that founded the universities and, in fact, dominated the universities until probably 75 years ago. I can show you addresses from the president of the University of California, Berkeley. You read them, you think you're listening to Robert Schuller. And see, that change has come very recently. It is a part of a socialization process that has gone on in history, I think a necessary one in many respects, in which the university had to divorce itself from the explicit institutions of religion and society. I ought to have stock in a book by Julie Rubin called The Making of the Modern University. I'm really pushing that. I'd urge you to rush right out and get it. She did her PhD at Stanford, and this dissertation developed. She's at Harvard now in the School of Education. I encourage you to get it and read it. And you will see how the socialization process went on. It wasn't that suddenly someone found out that Jesus was wrong. Nobody found that out. It was not discovered. It was negotiated over a period of time in which people decided that it would be that way and was able to set the tone against it. That's what happened. So where do we stand now? Well, the answers of Jesus constituted the worldview of the universities well into the 20th century. So we have been locked into a sociological, not an intellectual reaction. I think this is one of the hardest things for us to come to grips with. Because we like to think of ourselves as engaged in a rational enterprise in the universities. And we are apt, therefore, simply to miss or not understand the sociological realities that determine the worldview that is actually taught. So we have to understand that. That goes along with the disappearance of logic from the campus. There's almost no university or college in this country today that requires a course in simple logic as a part of the degree program. I don't know, is that true here? Is there anyone here that can take a course in formal logic and it count towards a requirement of a degree? Can I see your hand? I'm really interested in this. What college is it? Here?
Yeah.
And what course of studies is it?
Philosophy
31. Philosophy 31, and that's a requirement. Okay, all right. Well, that's for philosophy. I'm hopeful for philosophy because of that. And of course, they have a great tradition in logic here, and a great tradition, by the way, in what used to be called scientific philosophy when Hans Reichenbach was here. But in general, that's disappeared. Your argument is now judged by your conclusion, not your conclusion by your argument. So, for example, many people would hear this excellent presentation by Dr. There's something wrong. I don't know what it is, but he doesn't come out at the right place. See, that's how sociology works. I know you're wrong. And we've gone through a recent series of discussions on the campus about going to war in Iraq. I don't know if you listened to them, whether or not you were. Because there really wasn't much logic to it. It was a matter of determining what was the place to come out and then bending everything to get there. And people take different sides and no one's listening. And this is why it's so important for us to emphasize this point. We want to go back to the point to where your conclusion is judged by your argument, not your argument is judged by your conclusion. The answers of Jesus have not been shown false, and the now prevailing, sociologically prevailing answers true. That has not happened. But until you recover the sense of logic, you can never take that issue up. So, just very quickly, where are we now? Recognize that our worldview assumptions are what governs life. That would be true of a Christian, a non-Christian, anybody. Assume the burden of proof. I always tell my students, the burden of proof is always mine because I'm the one who wants to know. I'm not in this discussion to put you back on your heels. I'm here to determine the truth. And the burden of proof is mine. I'm not trying to win an argument. I think that's one of the most important things, especially for Christians to understand. They're not here trying to win. They're not here trying to duck and dodge. If you can find a better way than what is Jesus Christ offers, he would be the first person to tell you to take it. And if you don't believe that about him, you can't be his disciple because you could never trust him. We're not ducking, we're not dodging, we're just looking for the truth. And if veritas forum means anything, it means that. So thoroughly consider the teachings of the Bible and the record of Jesus' people on the main worldview issues. Put the teachings to the test of life. Do the same for the other worldviews. I mean, if I am just my brain and everything I'm thinking and doing is chemistry, I want to know that. I'm not trying to hide from that. I mean, the big issue is not if you're going to stop existing. If you're going to stop existing, you're out. It's like going to the dentist. It's unpleasant for a while, but it'll be over. The real problem comes if you're not going to stop existing. And then honestly compare. Don't just rest on our intellectually respectable prejudices. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Willard. We're now going to have a question and answer time in the spirit of this being a forum where we're trying to figure out what the truth is. And so if you guys want to start queuing up behind the microphones, make sure when you're going to ask your question, you toe the gray tape that's there so that we can all hear you and get this on tape for the enjoyment of those who will be listening to audio tapes and videotapes of this for years to come. While people are formulating these questions, I just wanted to point out that something profound, I think, was happening here tonight, and that was we were being encouraged to think. I don't think either of these gentlemen came to sell us upon any argument that they were making, but rather they really wanted us to think through what we've accepted through the indoctrination of just living. And I think Professor Willard helped us to see, and then I think Professor Kuhn showed us what to do once we do see. So maybe consider that as something to go on. It was helpful to me. I neglected to mention that one book that Professor Willard wrote on that question of how to be a good person came out recently. It's called Renovation of the Heart. I've been reading it and enjoying it greatly, so there's a plug for that. Are there any questions? Come forward, and why don't we have both of our speakers come forward to answer. You guys can negotiate who does what.
Well, first I want to just thank both of you for coming out. That was excellent. This question is for Professor Kuhns. I'm just wondering whether, this is perhaps a little bit tangential, but I'm wondering whether you'd consider intelligent design theory or young earth creationism a science, and depending on your answer, what follows from that, or is that a problem? If no.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question. I guess part of what I was trying to say, I guess, is that this question about what is and isn't science shouldn't really be our fundamental question. I mean, science, insofar as it means anything, just to me, means knowledge. It's just a fancy Latin word for knowledge. And there are these sociological facts about National Science Foundation and so on. And, you know, will they accept intelligent design? You know, probably not, right? So that makes it not science in that sociological sense. But who cares, right? To me, the really fundamental question is, for any of those ideas, young earth creationism, intelligent design, or whatever, is, are they reasonable? Do they have strong support in the evidence? Do they fit together with a coherent worldview and that sort of thing? So to me, those sort of fundamental questions of truth are the things to worry about, not these definitional questions about whether something is science or not.
Great. I think, thank you.
Oh, I'm exhausted. I'm going to need a miracle to get back up. Pray for me. I'm an atheist, but I really enjoyed the opening evening. I thank you both for your speech. In fact, I have so many questions for Dr. Kuhns, and I didn't have a pencil. Maybe I could meet up with you after if you had a couple spare moments. My question, and I was really impressed, Dr. Willard, as an atheist, if you just scratched out the term religion in a lot of your talk and just put in any other politically incorrect term. I would agree with you on virtually anything else. That's the problem on the university, so thanks for being here. You use the term, though, knowledge of God. I wouldn't argue that somebody can read and know the Bible or the Quran really well or know the customs and prayers really well and be sincere in their heart that it's true. But how can one know God if one can't at the same time know that miracles don't exist?
Well, actually, those are independent issues, logically. And you've had many people who had standard arguments, as it were, for the existence of God who have rejected miracles. So it depends on whether you're going to be a deist or a more full-blown kind of theist. Christian theists tend to depend upon the knowledge of miracles for their knowledge of God, at least partly.
What do you mean by that? Could you define that then?
Well, do you mean, for example, take the issue of the resurrection of Christ. Now, I don't go to that immediately if I'm arguing for the existence of God, but I do want to get around there. And so here you would just, I mean, it either happened or it didn't to begin with. So I don't agree with those who say, well, it's a religious matter and therefore it's not a fact, it's a value or something. But it either happened or it didn't. Now then, if it happened, or it didn't, there's got to be some related facts that we can look into that have a bearing on whether or not it happened. These might be deductive or probability arguments, but it would be straightforward evidence.
Can't we say then that you believe the resurrection? You don't know it per se?
Sure, you can say that.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
Absolutely. But now, see, the argument for, as I understand the context of this evening, it is really about knowledge.
Well, we can know what the texts say. We can know what the speakers say.
Yeah.
Can we really know that heaven exists? We can't buy a ticket and go there. We can know that Egypt or Israel or Asia exist.
Yeah.
I mean, we could. Yeah. We can
I understand your
that
point.
UCLA no. exists to the best of our abilities.
Yeah, sure. Your point is that in principle, there's no way that we could know that heaven exists, right? So I think where you would want to start there is, do we know that there is anything non-physical? And you start there and see where that leads. I define knowledge, may look like a kind of simple little thing, but it's a big deal. You know something if it is as you think it to be, and you think it to be that way on an appropriate basis of experience and thought. So that may be a pretty intricate path in the case of heaven, for example.
Well, I think that's why I personally use the word know, K-N-O-W, very rarely. There's very little I can know about that. You have a belief about heaven. A Hindu might, I don't know enough about Hinduism, might have a different belief about heaven. You both feel you know it based on your experience, based on your study, based on your relationship with God or gods. Doesn't mean you K-N-O-W know it, capital.
No, I agree with that.
Okay.
I don't have any.
Thank you.
And many people, for example, only believe things which other people know. Right. So, I mean, that's true, for example, nearly everything that I believe about atomic or nuclear physics. I only believe things which Steve Weinberg and possibly Dr. Kunz here actually knows. So, to the thought and experience that you had. Now, I mean, here's a very simple line. Suppose that Jesus is actually the Son of God. And suppose he says there's a heaven. Now, that's an authority argument. And if you can establish those two points, then you would have evidence to believe in heaven.
Fair enough.
And now, I'm not saying you can, heaven, because that's a long discussion.
Right. Heaven might have been a bad example. I mean, certainly Muslims might believe in heaven. I don't think we'd argue that most Muslims would believe different people wind up in heaven than most evangelical Christians believe will wind up in heaven, and most Jews would also believe differently.
Right. You know. Yeah, I'm thinking of a realm of existence in which persons continue to exist after their bodies cease to exist. Right.
Follow up briefly on that. I'd say, too, that one shouldn't be too quick to rule out the possibility of knowledge. If a physicist tells me that he knows that there are quarks, I'd say, well, how do you know that? Have you ever seen them? Do they ever exist by themselves? He'd say, no. I'd say, well, how can you know them then? Well, there's a long, complicated chain of reasoning that gets the physicist to knowing that. So I shouldn't sort of jump to conclusions that, well, he doesn't know it. And I think it's similar with some theological claims like there's heaven or that Jesus is God. I mean, yeah, I can't give you a 3-minute, you know, breeze through the argument exactly, but there is a chain of reasoning that leads to that conclusion. So.
That's an awfully important point, I think, and really, we are not receptive to it often because we think this shouldn't be like technical knowledge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know. That's right. We think it's got to be easy, but it's
it would be obvious.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Dr. Willard, you had mentioned during your outlining of the history of the secularization of the university that it was necessarily so, and possibly indicating that this is a good thing. How will I, as a person that does research in the sciences, and yet also have faith in Christ, integrate that? And is that a wrong thing to do then if, let's say, that the segregation of faith and the academy is actually a good thing?
the question again.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, I just didn't quite follow.
Well, you had indicated that the separation between the support of the institution of Christ and institution of learning is a necessary thing.
Well, let me tell you why I think that was true. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you read the Rubens book, I'm not getting a cut on that book, but I'm pushing it hard. because if you read it's very helpful. Because what happened actually was this. In the period right after the Second World War, the colleges, most of them were colleges at that time, but let's just say colleges and universities, were thought not to be training people well for the future of the country. They were concerned particularly about technology and about science, but they were also concerned about international relations and things of that sort. Because the colleges were basically classical colleges, training in Greek and Latin and literature and history, some history and so on. So there was a lot of criticism in this. And then they began to push towards, and what they experienced was this. Nearly all of the colleges and universities were closely aligned with denominations. And that includes the ones that we think of as the best ones today, Princeton, Harvard, Yale, and so on. And so what they found was that the denominational distinctives were not open to inquiry. And if you think of what C.S. Lewis calls mere Christianity, which is basically the great creedal tradition, pretty heavy on doctrine and metaphysics, frankly. And then you add on all the things that makes the difference between a Congregationalist and an Episcopalian, Presbyterian, and so on. These are very deep issues in American history. You see that these denominational schools just closed down their minds at certain points. They were not going to be open to inquiry into how you get baptized. Right? Because they already knew. And so that is why there had to be an opening up of a distance between institutional religion and free inquiry. And I think that that was a good thing, and I still think it's a good thing. Because I think, in fact, the truths of religion should be open to the same kind of scrutiny that any other, or the claims of religion, that any other field is open to. And the truth is that historically religion has not been. And that's why there had to be some distance. Hopefully there will be a rapprochement of religion, understood now not narrowly as, I'm a Methodist and you're a Presbyterian and you're a Catholic and so forth, not even to mention those Greek Orthodox and all that sort of thing. So you see that spread. Well, hopefully that's coming to mean less and less. And as it does so, I think then we can go back to saying, look, it doesn't matter. Let's open it up. Let's have free inquiry. And in fact, what I'm groaning and complaining about tonight is we don't have that. And we don't have it now from the secular side, because the secular side has trained itself more or less to say that religion is not open to inquiry. And that's the change that had to be made.
Thanks.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your presentation tonight. It was great. Kind of a more practical question. What steps? It's twofolded, actually. First of all, what steps do you feel can be taken to encourage people to have sort of open forums like this where people can argue without being argumentative and try to reach the truth? What practical steps can you take to continue this? And second of all, do you see in the university, do you see it going in a positive direction or a negative direction?
Yeah, let's see. I'm not very good at prognosticating, really. Back in the late 80s, I was pretty sure the Soviet Union was going to last 1,000 years. I mean, didn't really, it was a complete shock to me that it lasts. So, so caveat emptor for as far as my predictions go on that. I think in philosophy, things have gotten considerably better in my lifetime. I mean, I think if you were to go back 50 years, you'd be in a situation where it would be very, not only would you find few Christians in philosophy, it would be very hard to even squeeze the subject into the conversation, because it was all about how, what exactly the logic of natural science is in a very mechanical sort of way that just didn't leave any room for anything else. And we're in a kind of golden age in philosophy right now of a rebirth of metaphysics, and that's opened up some space for Christians. I don't know exactly what it's like in some of the other fields. My impression is that, especially some of the social sciences, things are very, very tough still. It's also situations where it's hard to squeeze the Christian viewpoint into the conversation. What can you do? I think students can actually make a big difference. I think students underestimate the impact they can have on the university and on their teachers, because if you're willing to ask those awkward questions, you can actually force your teacher to rethink things that he hasn't thought about. You can make a difference. In biology, if you raise some awkward questions about intelligent design, or in literature, or history, or economics, there are all kinds of fields where you can, if you can do some thinking about it, about what are the philosophical, theological underpinnings, and raise some of the awkward questions in discussion, you can really make a difference. I really liked what Dr. Willard said about the sociological facts, and it is very important that we need to be aware of that and to be sort of intentional about penetrating that to some extent. I remember a few years ago, David Lewis, a famous philosopher, came to UT to give a talk, and he just started out his talk, as many people do, with, well, of course I'm going to start out assuming materialism is true, you know, who wouldn't, and then gave his talk. And then, you know, I asked a question early on in the discussion, and I just parenthetically, so to speak, I said, well, I'm not actually a materialist, but for the sake of argument, I'll go ahead and assume it along with you, and then I asked some sort of specific question. So it was intentional. I mean, I knew what I was doing, but it was just a parenthetical remark that didn't call for any further comment. But every one of my colleagues made a point of prefacing their remarks by saying, well, I am a materialist, and I think blah, 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 you know, and then they gave their response. So just by you know, in that very short, simple kind of thing, I'd made suddenly an issue salient that hadn't been salient before. And I'm not tooting my horn, but I'm just saying that's kind of a small example of what you can do in those sort of small ways to shift the sociological dynamics of the classroom.
I think that's really important, and the work you did tonight is very important sociologically. And we need, as students and faculty, to occasionally say, when someone says, I'm a materialist, well, let's see. Here's your conclusion, materialism. Now, what were the premises? Let's list them. See?
Yeah.
That's where the logic comes in. I mean, I was joking about people lying awake at night because someone thought they were unscientific, but that's true. Mm-hmm. John Searle up here at Berkeley, he wouldn't sleep at night at all he is just so dead set on this. And God only knows, I trust God knows, what scientific means to the man. Right? And you say, well, now, John, do you mean that your views follow from some science? Which science? Now, you can't answer the question. And that's the point. The logic is very important on this. It's the heart of the battle. And we have other issues, like journalism today is not in it. Why don't journalists pay the attention to Al Plantinga that they do to Richard Dawkins? Yeah. They certainly get a lot better arguments. Right? But see, journalists have decided what's sexy and what's not. Mm-hmm. And so they push that, and people say, well, there's all this discussion, and they don't know to look for the argument, wouldn't know how to do if someone has said that that book of Hawking's is the most widely unread book on Earth. You know? A short story of space and time or something.
Yes.
Who's in a position to read that thing and come to a conclusion? Well, you know, you'd have to really work at it. But some journalist gets on and says, blah, 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 and there you go. But who's going to take Bill Alston or Al Plantinga or St. Thomas Aquinas, for that matter, and say, hey, here's a great mind, and he said, you better get ready for the next world. You know? Well, you might as well moon somebody as say that to them. In this context, because they just think, ugh. So I do think there's some hope, but it's going to depend on people being vocal and thoughtful and being present and pointing out what's really going on here.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.